It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back in on Monday. Coming up, the U.S. Senate has seen a massive change in the last 30 years in partisanship and effectiveness. But the key player wasn't in the Senate at all. We'll hear about the rise of the Gingrich senators. First, we're continuing our Aging Wisconsin series. In Wisconsin, it's estimated that around 120,000 people, that's 120,000 people, have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. Those numbers could triple by 2050 because of the aging baby boomer population. Kristen Durst reports on the challenges dementia caregivers currently face and what it'll take to meet their needs in the years to come.
It was November 11th, 2010. Jennifer Jakeway's husband, Jim, had just rolled through a stop sign near their home in the village of Mount Horeb. He got pulled over.
And instead of sitting in the car and waiting for the officer to come up and say, "Sir, did you know that you just rolled that stop sign?" He got out of the car and approached the officer. And then they said, "You need to get back into your car." And he refused. And he said, "I didn't do anything wrong," and got very defensive. So they proceeded to handcuff him and throw him in the back of the squad.
Jennifer had noticed Jim's behavior had changed recently, but having her previously law-abiding husband in handcuffs, she said, was a real turning point. It was about a month later when he was diagnosed.
So it's the deterioration of his frontal lobe of his brain and temporal, and that's the frontal lobe, of course, is what controls your executive functioning, your decision-making, your insight, judgment, your personality.
The disease has caused Jim's personality to change, so much so that Jennifer says today she's married to a very different man. The new Jim can be confrontational and inappropriate, and at least once a week she says he has a huge meltdown. And because of the dementia, he can no longer work or drive. He lives at home while Jennifer works full-time and coordinates his care.
The way you really save money with dementia is to keep people at home. If you put them into a nursing home, the average nursing home cost in Wisconsin is $93,000 a year right now.
That's Rob Gunderman of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin. Wisconsin's aging population is set to explode and the costs could skyrocket. So keeping dementia patients in their homes for as long as possible, he says, is necessary. By 2015, the Department of Health Services says Wisconsin will have over 900,000 people 65 years and older.
That is roughly 117,000 more than were 65 in 2010. So in 5 years, we're gaining 117,000 65-year-olds.
DHS Secretary Kitty Rhodes says connecting people with resources to help keep them in their homes and save for longer is the only way the state will be able to afford the population boom. But she says there are challenges in rural areas of the state where public transportation and services can be lacking. Jennifer Jakeway actually packed up and moved her family from Mount Horeb to nearby Madison.
Because it was too difficult for me to get him in and out to activities. You know, Madison is rich with resources and things that were very appropriate and meaningful that Jim likes to participate in, but I just couldn't get him to everything.
In Madison, a paratransit bus picks him up at the door. While Jennifer works, Jim is able to go to adult daycare 3 times a week, as well as other dementia-specific programs and physical therapy. Gunderman of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance says those are resources that really pay off.
Being able to get, say, adult daycare 1 day a week paid for, then that enables the caregiver to not burn out. And caregiver burnout is one of the things that will trigger sending someone into a nursing home.
Jakeway says with help, she hopes to keep her 61-year-old husband at home for as long as possible.
Because of the access to services and transportation, I don't have to do it all.
And she says not having to do it all allows her to keep her job, and that provides her with very important and necessary time away. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
On Monday, our Aging Wisconsin series concludes with a look at the challenges facing older drivers and their families. Once upon a time, the U.S. Senate was known as the more functional, more collegial, and less partisan half of Congress. But our next guest says that's changed in the last couple of generations. He sees a major shift in the style and the effectiveness of the upper house, and he says a lot of it came from a cadre of newcomers since 1978 who graduated from the House of Representatives to the Senate. He calls them the Gingrich Senators. Sean Theriault is with us now. He's Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas and author of the new book, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, what was the Senate like before the change in my once upon a time scenario there?
Right. So when we think about the Senate of the middle part of the 20th century, we think of an institution that was able to strike compromise, where people were able to talk across the aisle and figure out when there were huge problems that America confronted, what the solutions to those problems would be. In fact, throughout the 20th century, all sorts of different political scientists and journalists would comment on how the Senate was the one place where they could still see politics getting done and problems being solved.
So it was the House of Compromise versus the House of Representatives, which is the more divided House.
That's right. I mean, the House has always had this kind of majoritarian feel where whichever party was the majority party, they were able to force their will. But just because of the rules of the Senate has always been that place where you need to talk across the aisle in order to get problems solved.
Well, the change starts not in the Senate, but in the House with the arrival of Newt Gingrich and his colleagues. First of all, before we even get to the Senate, how did they change business as usual in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, first we have to go back to the time when Newt Gingrich enters the House. So he enters in 1978, which is 2 years before Ronald Reagan's election. And even in his first term, he was a different kind of politician. He was more confrontational. He was less willing to go along, to get along. He wanted the Republican Party to differentiate itself. But then shortly after his arrival, we get the 1980 election. And in that election, I think we don't think of how transformative that was in Washington, D.C. We not only had a Republican entering the White House again, there had been Republicans in the White House just 4 years earlier. But more importantly, the House saw the Senate Republicans for the first time banging gavels and chairing committees since the 1950s. And so the Republicans were in a minority only in the House of Representatives. And so it was really easy for the message of Newt Gingrich to be more confrontational, to be more differentiating from the Democratic Party, for that to resonate among his colleagues. And of course, there were lots of old-time Republicans, people like Bob Michael, and who had been in the House for years and years, and who still saw the benefits of going along to get along. But with each succeeding class that was entering the House of Representatives, they were kind of raised in this more confrontational style. Newt Gingrich was out in the districts recruiting volunteers to run for Congress, and they were being successful. And so it was a strategy that was building upon itself as more and more people were entering the Republican conference with that confrontational mindset.
Newt Gingrich never entered the Senate, but a lot of the people you're talking about, ones he recruited or helped shape their political career and outlook, did. How many of the Gingrich senators have there been over the years?
So there's been over 40 now. There's 44 to be exact. And there are 22 who are still serving in the Senate. So that means that more than 20 have either lost or retired.
Okay, so these are senators who came up from the House or worked with Newt Gingrich, but is there really something different in the way they vote, the way they do politics?
Yeah, so they vote so differently. This is the one measure that we as a political scientist can measure. We see how senators day after day after day are voting on the Senate floor. And when we look at the class of people that served in the House of Representatives in the era of Newt Gingrich, so after 1978, they vote distinctly differently than either the people who came from the House before 1978 or people who never served in the House. In fact, by some measures, they're more than 60% more conservative than what I term other Republicans who are serving in the Senate at the time.
Is there a similar phenomenon on the Democratic side? You look to see whether there was a group of Gephardt senators named after Richard Gephardt.
Yeah, that's right, because Dick Gephardt enters about the same time that Newt Gingrich does. Initially, when I started this whole research project, I didn't come up with this idea myself, but I was looking at the literature in political science, and it said that the reason the Senate was changing was because these former House members were coming in. And so sure enough, when I started looking at the data and I see who previously served in the House, I saw that, sure, House members were adding something different. They were voting more ideological than before. And then I just on a whim decided to separate it by party. So look and see how Democrats voted versus Republicans who'd served in the House. And it was a one-party phenomenon. So the Democrats who were coming over from the House weren't voting any differently than they ever had or voting any differently than people who hadn't served in the House. It was only people who served in the Republican Party who were coming over from the House. And so then when I looked at the cost of time, I saw that, in fact, when Republicans were coming over from the House in the 50s and 60s, they were voting more moderately. But there was a clear break that happens in the late 1970s, right at the time that Newt Gingrich is elected, where they start entering the Senate and voting much more conservatively. And it makes sense because the Democratic Party in the House in the 1970s and 80s was the majority party. So there was no reason for the Democratic Party to have this confrontational style, this differentiation that was so important to Newt Gingrich. They were the minority party. And so he knew that the only way to shift this imbalance where the Republicans could someday become a majority party was by having this more confrontational style.
We're talking to Sean Theriault, professor at the University of Texas. In his new book, The Gingrich Senators, he makes the case that Newt Gingrich, though not a senator himself, played a key role in changing the U.S. Senate because of his colleagues who went up there, voted differently, and acted differently. It's now more partisan, less able to get things done than it was, say, in the middle of the last century. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation now with Sean Theriault. He's author of The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. He makes the case that the U.S. Senate underwent a fundamental shift in the last 30 years or so, resulting in a more partisan, more divisive atmosphere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you agree? Have you seen that change? Why do you think it's happened? Before we get to your calls, Sean, I wanted to ask, you mentioned how the Gingrich senators, the people who went from the House to the Senate in the Gingrich era and beyond, vote more conservatively, more consistently, more ideologically. Do they behave differently? Has it changed the climate in the Senate and how it works?
It has. And a harder task for political scientists are trying to figure out the behavioral changes, because with roll call votes, we can look and see how people are voting. But when it comes time for figuring out how people are going to compromise, how people are going to negotiate over a budget or the debt ceiling, or whether or not people are going to co-sponsor bills across the aisle, it gets harder for us because those data aren't readily available. Through a series of episodes, I examined the behavioral aspects of the Senate, and I find that it's some of the greatest failures that the Senate have had over the last 5 or 6 years. At each turn, the reason that they're not solving problems is because there's a set of Republicans who aren't doing something that they said that they would. And sure enough, when I go back and look who those people were, more times than not, great preponderance of the time there are the Gingrich senators and in fact themselves. And so when we look at the behavioral stuff, we find that the other Republicans in many ways are behaving just as they always had and just as the Democrats are today. But it's just the set of folks who learn the politics of Newt Gingrich in the House and then transferred that experience to their service in the Senate that have caused this fundamental shift in the Senate.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Brookfield. Steve, hi.
Hello. I was just wondering if your data shows any connection between the greater influence of special interest money with this group of senators. Did that change occur, and are they speaking more from special interest influence?
Thanks for your question, Steve. That's really insightful. So I don't actually look at too much of what's happening among interest groups and who they're donating money to. But in terms of the campaigns that the Gingrich senators are running, because they are more conservative, they've had to offset their conservatism by raising a lot more money. And in fact, they have. So in order to survive at approximately the same rate as other Republicans who have a more moderate voting record, they've had to raise a lot more money, sometimes as many as 20-30% more than the other Republicans, in order to maintain their electoral viability. And no doubt, had I dug a little deeper to find out where that money is coming from, that I could have found it. An interesting side note here is that a lot of the funding that happened for what I'm now calling the Tea Party senators comes from Jim DeMint and the Senate Conservative Fund. And so that one particular special interest has had an enormous effect on how the Senate operates.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to David in Lyons. David, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for the topic. This is great. It's good to have some openness there. I think you're giving... I think you're giving the Gingrich a little bit too much credit, and I think that the senators and congressmen that vote conservative are voting that way because that's what their constituents are requiring of them. That's why they're voted in. I know that there was a bit of divisiveness that began back in the 80s, but don't give Gingrich that much credit. And, you know, the Democrats aren't innocent in the partisan politics either. It's just it's way too far apart now. And we do need a coalition between both ideologies to be able to get some things done in this country.
David, interesting points and questions there. Thanks for calling. So that main point, it's not a Gingrich-led wave. It's constituencies wanting conservative senators.
Yeah. So and that's exactly what I thought. When I looked at the folks of senators that I'm calling the Gingrich senators, I look at the states that they come from Georgia and Louisiana and Oklahoma. And I thought, surely David was right in his comments. And so what I do is I look at how each of those states voted in the previous presidential election. And then I don't want to get in the weeds too much here, but I control for that in looking at how they vote. And when I parse all of that out and the computer spits out the numbers, it tells me that only about 20% of the conservative nature of the Gingrich senators is a consequence of their conservative states from which they come. Because there's also some Gingrich senators who come from states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, and some of those more purple or even blue states, Colorado is another example. And so there certainly is an element that these folks are coming from more conservative states. But even still, they're voting more conservative than we would think. Then they would be coming from those conservative states.
So two Republican senators from the same conservative state, one of them is one of these Gingrich senators, came up through the House, one wasn't. There's going to be a probably noticeable voting difference, you're saying.
Yeah, there is. And so throughout the book, I'm always what I call the Senate pairs. I'm comparing the two senators, one of them who, as you say, comes from the House under Newt Gingrich and the other one who doesn't. And sure enough, 90% of the time, the more conservative of the two are the ones that came up through the House in the era of Newt Gingrich.
Thanks a lot for the call. We've got John on the line now in Windsor. John, hi.
Hi. A classic example of that is Rick Santorum. You know, he would never have won in Pennsylvania. He was so conservative, but, you know, he did. I would totally agree with you, the speaker, and totally disagree with the previous person. Newt Gingrich basically drove Bob Michael out of Congress. And then, you know, when you think about the tactics that he used in Congress with the cameras when they started C-SPAN, and he would go on his rages every night, until what happened was that they decided they were going to back up the cameras and show there was nobody in the audience.
You described that episode in the book, Sean. John, thanks for the call. So he agrees that Newt Gingrich is a powerful influence. Now, I should ask, how much of this is Newt Gingrich himself leading these Gingrich senators, or how much of it is he's a sign of an era? Sean.
Right. So I think that he is a sign of an era. One of the ways I try and peel back the layers a little bit is looking at people who might have a closer personal relationship with Newt Gingrich. So how long did they serve in the House? Were they part of Newt Gingrich's leadership team? Were they part of the Congressional Campaign Committee? And all of those individual kind of closeness to Newt Gingrich factors don't matter that much. What matters is that they served at the House during a particular time when the Republican Conference was going through a radical transformation from being one like the previous caller John talked about with Bob Michael to being one that was very much kind of built in the image of Newt Gingrich. And it was serving in that more partisan, confrontational Republican Conference had transformed them. And of course, that transformation only happens because of Newt Gingrich.
Sean, we've talked about maybe downside in terms of not getting things done in Congress, but is there an upside here? Maybe we should have ideologically consistent parties that fight for the principles that people elected them to represent.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, one of the benefits of party polarization is that we know what party stands for issues, and we know what the other party and the issues that they stand for. So there's a clear distinction that the voters have. And I think that's healthy for democracy. But what I think has to happen is after the election happens, all the legislators need to come to Washington and they need to solve our problems. And that's what's not getting done. You know, I have to give kudos to Newt Gingrich, because if he hadn't embarked on this strategy of transforming the Republican Conference, it's likely that the Republicans would still be a minority in the House of Representatives. But he recognized that they needed to transform the way that they did business and within 14 years of Ronald Reagan's election, sure enough, Newt Gingrich is banging the Speaker's gavel in the House of Representatives. So there's no doubt that it was a successful strategy. But we need to get the folks to come back to Washington and to solve our real problems.
We'll leave it there and maybe talk about that again in the future. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
That was Sean Theriault. He's professor at the University of Texas. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Gingrich Senators. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back next week. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll put a historical twist on Food Friday with a look at the development of what might be America's most iconic spirit, bourbon. First, though, the UW System's smallest four-year college, UW-Superior, is grappling with a $2.5 million structural deficit. The chancellor of the school announced yesterday that they're suspending or cutting 15 programs, including almost half of the graduate studies at the school, among other cost-cutting measures. WPR reporter Mike Simonson is based in Superior. He joins us now from our studio there. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what kind of programs are they talking about cutting there?
Well, they're looking at visual arts programs. Art education would be cut. And these are master's programs, mass media, and reading specialist, library science. In all, it's 12, and I got my figures wrong, it's 12 of 25 graduate programs. And that's the stuff that has to do with the academic side of things. On the other side of things, they're looking at outsourcing, privatizing pretty much everything that isn't academic, like campus security. IT. They're already outsourcing the bookstore. That'll kick in July, and Westman Arena, which is their sports arena, that will be privatized by the end of this year. So it's, they're looking at custodial grounds crews, just about anything and everything.
We'll dig a little deeper into those changes, but first, you know, on some campuses, $2.5 million on a larger campus might not be a huge amount. What does that mean in the scope of a school the size of UW-Superior?
Well, UW-Superior is unique, although there are other campuses that are also showing fund balances that are shrinking rather alarmingly fast, and that's from a large school, UW-Milwaukee, and then the smaller Parkside, Stout, as well as Superior. Their fund balance is Superior's in the negative. The others are shrinking fast. But you're right, the full-time, about 2,500 students are on campus here, so that's a drop in the bucket to the larger campuses like Madison. So any kind of cut like that will have more impact on a small budget.
What is the administration of UW-Superior chalking up the shortfall to?
They call it the nexus of tuition freeze, legislative cuts over the past 4 years, but also there's some debt servicers, some nice new buildings up here, but they're paying off on the debt, and some of the promised donations for paying for it haven't come through, so they're carrying more debt service. And then a rather cryptic decisions that should have been made a few years ago weren't made, and now UW-Superior is paying for that. But, you know, this is something that a lot of universities, I think the entire system, is watching very closely to see how this handles, because the consequences of the legislative action and the tuition freeze may be first felt here at such a small campus.
But that legislative action and the tuition freeze were in part in response to what was perceived anyway as too high a reserve fund around the UW system. The university might want that reserve fund in case of something like this, so it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, the critics, mostly the Republican legislators, were saying that, hey, these are pots of money, and it did exceed $1 billion at one point. It no longer is that. So that was, what are you guys doing with all this cash hanging around? But really, the UW system says that this cash has always been designated. It wasn't just sitting around. And in some cases, like the smaller campuses I mentioned, they didn't have those pots of money, those reserves that really are making First UW-Superior look at some really drastic changes.
Well, and you mentioned the idea of outsourcing. Is this the first at a UW campus?
At a four-year campus. Mm-hmm. UW-Marathon has done some outsourcing. That's a two-year campus, and perhaps others have, but this is the first time a four-year campus is doing things like custodians, grounds crew, and they haven't made any final decisions up here yet on that, but they did send all of the 26 grounds and custodians at-risk letters saying that they could be laid off in 2 weeks. And I tell you what, you talk to a custodian around here right now, and everybody is very, very down in the mouth.
And you sent us a clip with some of the, I think, union response to the outsourcing. Let's give a listen.
You call, they come. Whether it's a flood, whether it's a broken basketball hoop, they know that stuff. And that's what we need, people who know and people who care about the community, and they are the community.
So talking about the institutional memory of the people who are being laid off here.
Right. A lot of these men and women have been on this job and know all for 10, 20, 30 years. They know all the nooks and crannies, but they also have relationships with faculty and with students. As one custodian said, look, if a student needs directions to get someplace, I won't give them the directions. I will take them to that place until they feel comfortable on the campus.
On the union side of this, do they have any room to negotiate here?
No, not with Act 10, which really took a lot of the negotiating power, almost all the negotiating power from the public unions. What they're trying to do is advise the workers what their options are. But really, except for them forming companies to bid for privatization jobs on the UW-Superior campus, there isn't a whole lot they can do except perhaps exert public pressure.
You mentioned that other UW system schools will be watching in part because of the impact of the tuition freeze. Are they going to be watching and taking notes on how outsourcing goes over and how much money is saved?
I think so. There are faculty members here who are not at risk, but they're putting up signs, you know, save our custodians, save our ground crews. It's something that is endemic as part of the university community, and so they're rallying around it. And I heard on a Joy's show somebody call up a few days ago and say, look what's happening at UW-Superior, watch that.
And one change that was floated and then taken back, the theater program, it evidently was going to be suspended. That's being reconsidered. What happened there?
Well, I'm not sure, but Chancellor Wachter said told the communicating arts faculty on Monday that theater is suspended, theater's canceled. And 2 days later, she changed her mind, backpedaled on it, and I asked her about that yesterday, and she says, well, let's just say some alumni stepped forward. So I think the heat was on for that decision because theater is such an outreach thing. It is such a part of the community. Even though the enrollment is small for theater, a lot of people get enjoyment out of it and look forward to that. And it really wouldn't have saved much money, so that's all part of the political pressure thing, though. Do custodians have that kind of political pressure that perhaps alum have or, you know, a theater program has?
So long term, is there concern about what the impact's going to be here on UW-Superior's image, ability to attract students from around the state and beyond?
Well, some people are going to say, hey, you know, you got to cut, you got to cut, you got to economize, you got to look at things, you got to change with the times. And other people are going to say, maybe we need to talk to our legislators and change priorities. The legislature made the technical colleges a larger priority and increased funding so they can work with programs to link with private sector jobs. And perhaps that's going to be part of the UW system change, too, is to become more and more relevant. But in the meantime, what happens up here could have a ripple effect on the whole system.
And Mike, can you leave us a sense of how important the UW-Superior campus is as part of the Superior community as a whole?
It is everything. I mean, shipping, of course, the port is very important, but culturally speaking, educationally speaking, and a lot of people work here too. it's just a place where the hometown kid can go to school and learn. It's a point of pride, and they even have a pretty good hockey team.
All right, Mike, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
I've been speaking with Superior-based WPR reporter Mike Simonson. He's updating us on a program on program cuts at UW-Superior announced yesterday. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today on Food Friday, we've got a historical twist. The history of one of America's most iconic foods, beverages really, is uniquely intertwined with American history itself. According to our guest, the beverage is bourbon. Well, the name may sound, a bit French, the Bourbon Dynasty there. There's not much French about it. Probably the most closely associated with the American frontier, Kentucky in particular, the corn-based barrel-aged spirit is American all the way. Well, we've got Dane Hucklebridge with us now. He's got a new book out on bourbon. It's called Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. Dane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, it was fascinating to read in your book, early colonial days, all the hardships, far from home, and one of the main complaints colonists had was, we don't have good booze here. And that's what led them to turn corn into alcohol in the first place. What were some of the first steps there?
Sure. Well, I mean, what you had was, in those very early colonial days, the first English settlers, they really did not like to drink water. And, with bitter reason, in hindsight, they thought it was poisonous. And it was because so often, people would drink from polluted water sources and get sick from it. So they, in that period in time amongst Englishmen, they really avoided water as a drink. So as a substitute, they drank lots of alcoholic beverages, both higher in alcohol and lower in alcohol. The problem being, when they came to Virginia, suddenly that was a really long beer run crossing the Atlantic. So they had to figure out a way to start producing their own alcoholic beverages locally. And it's really, since they didn't really have that much barley and it didn't grow well, they started looking into making alcohol from native grains, one of which was corn. And that's really those very early days in Virginia when you first start seeing alcohol being made from corn, which is the basis of bourbon whiskey.
So 1620 or so is where you attribute the birth of bourbon. Some purists disagree. Would a modern-day bourbon drinker tasting that early corn alcohol recognize it as bourbon?
Well, probably not, because under most circumstances it would not have been aged. I mean, if it would have been aged back then, it probably would have happened so by accident. So if it just so happened that you had some very early colonial whiskey that had been forgotten about or left to sit for and spend some time in a barrel, then in that case, I think it's possible it would be recognizable as something, if not bourbon, relatively close. But for most of that period, they weren't really aging their whiskey. It would have been consumed, almost immediately when it's still clear right out of the still.
These guys couldn't wait.
Yeah, they just couldn't wait. It was a hard life. They needed a drink, I guess.
Now, they weren't calling it bourbon then. Where and when did that name come about?
Sure. Well, as bourbon, it comes from Bourbon, Kentucky, this region. And today, Bourbon County is a very small county, and they don't even make any whiskey there, to my knowledge. But once upon a time, it was much larger. And there was a whole big region of sort of central and eastern Kentucky that was referred to as the Bourbon Region or Bourbon County. And that took its name from, the Bourbon Dynasty from France. And right after the Revolution, when all of that land was opening up for settlement, people had a lot of gratitude to the French for helping us win the war with England. So you see a lot of French names in that area, one of which is this Bourbon County, this Bourbon region, and they started making corn whiskey. And probably, they first started making the whiskey in the late 1700s. I think the first real mention of it in print anyway, being called bourbon whiskey, is 1820. That was around there anyway. That was a little bit of an anomaly. But by the 1840s, 1850s, the name has definitely caught on. And by the time of the Civil War, this bourbon whiskey was known both north and south throughout America.
And by the end of the Civil War, it was popular enough that people were making fake bourbon or selling not bourbon as bourbon. And it ended up causing a major scandal in American politics. Tell us about that.
Indeed. Well, that area, that time after the Civil War, the Gilded Age, was just beset by all manner of corporate greed and corruption. And, whiskey was not exempt. There was quite a bit of corruption in whiskey, both literally in that a lot of distilleries outside of Kentucky in particular were turning out very low quality sort of fake whiskey, fake bourbon, and trying to sell it as bourbon. But also, even, the bigger scope, there's a lot of government corruption. There was the whiskey ring I mentioned in the book. There was this So basically the distillers, some of these unscrupulous distillers and politicians were in cahoots, and they weren't paying the taxes they should have been on this low-quality bourbon, and, you know, they weren't reporting it, and they were bribing the government officials. And this scandal ended up going all the way, you know, all the way to the White House, potentially all the way up to Grant, and that's a big kind of black eye for America and the whiskey industry.
And moving ahead to the 1890s, another war, not really a literal war, I don't think, a whiskey war, mainly in Kentucky, between established producers and others. What was the whiskey war, and what was the outcome?
Well, in a way, yeah, that was a direct offshoot of what I mentioned. You had the more traditional bourbon distilleries in Kentucky who still made their product, you know, purely from their mash bill, their corn, aged it in charred oak barrels and let it sit there for through the years and turned out, you know, a more high quality, authentic product. And then scattered mostly outside Kentucky in a lot in cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati and New Orleans as well, you had other distillers who were essentially just trying to make a quick buck turning out fake bourbon. They would just take grain alcohol and dye it and add flavorings and other unsavory chemicals to try to make it imitate that aging process. And that's what caused this conflict, was that the bourbon makers in Kentucky really resented the fact that these people outside of the region were giving their whiskey a bad name by turning out this sort of fake product. And that eventually culminated in the Bottle and Bond Act, which is 1897, I believe, and then the Pure Food and Drug Act a little less than 10 years later, which finally, you know, set that standard. The government finally, you know, got its act together and made a clear definition of what real bourbon was.
So now we get a legal definition for bourbon, and not too long after, bourbon and most other booze is illegal. How did Prohibition affect the bourbon industry?
Yeah, it's ironic, but it's true. And It's interesting. Prohibition, I think, on a cultural level, bourbon and, you know, the jazz age, the lost generation, they're very intertwined. So, you know, bourbon definitely kind of put a fire and put some music in that age. But in terms of the effect it had on the industry, it was disastrous. And the only way that distilleries could stay in business was if they got a medicinal permit, because you could still get whiskey with a doctor's prescription. And very few, you know, only a handful of Kentucky distillers ever were able to get those permits. So quite a few distilleries went out of business. You had all manner of corruption and organized crime that was trying to get their hands on these sort of government-controlled stores of whiskey and get it up to speakeasies. And it was just kind of a nasty time. And it really took the whiskey industry, the bourbon industry, a long time to recover. Because even what happened was when Prohibition was lifted, it still, they hadn't been making whiskey in over a decade, really. So you didn't have, you know, and whiskey has to sit in barrels to age, so there was no aged whiskey to sell. So they had to really figure out ways to start turning a profit, and you start getting lower quality bourbon. And that went right into the World War II shortly after, when the whiskey industry again had to quit making bourbon to help the war effort. So I think there was a really tough few decades right after right after Prohibition that put a real dent in the bourbon industry.
We've got these Kentucky bourbon companies. Jim Beam is one that pops to mind. You write that for the most part, they haven't been owned by people in Kentucky for a long time. Chicago investors, and this year, Japanese company taking over. Does that affect the bourbon that America is drinking?
Well, it's funny. I think it, you know, the bourbon industry, there's some truth behind it, but generally, you know, part of marketing is oftentimes projecting like a real authentic Americana heritage ideal, which is true in some ways, but also bourbon, just like America, has become a big corporate global enterprise. So, you know, it's quite a few of the, you know, distilleries are owned by larger conglomerates, international companies and whatnot. So, you know, it's a little bit of a myth that bourbon is this kind of old-timey, you know, log cabin and racehorse type thing. It's a modern big business.
I just wanted to ask before we're done, at the other end of the spectrum, we've got a micro distillery movement making lots of vodkas and gins and things like that. Is it harder to break into bourbon because of the aging issue?
Well, actually it is. I mean, that's what I find especially fascinating about the bourbon landscape at the moment, is you have these traditional big distilleries, but then there's this whole new batch of small craft distilleries popping up. And it is true that it's tough to break into, specifically because you have to wait so long to start turning a profit. And that's why many smaller craft distilleries that make bourbon, oftentimes they start out making an unaged spirit like vodka or gin, you know, to start turning money while their first batch is aging, or in some cases other tricks like using smaller barrels, which tend to age the whiskey a little quicker, or buying you know, aged spirits from other distilleries and blending them themselves. You know, there's certain things they can do, but it definitely is hard.
Dane, got to ask, how do you take your bourbon?
I like it neat. I like a neat glass of bourbon. I'm not too picky, but, you know, I won't turn down the good stuff.
I go neat usually, or it makes a fine Manhattan. Do you have a brand or two that you're recommending lately?
You always hear about Pappy Van Winkle, and it's great stuff if you can find it and afford it, which I oftentimes have trouble with both. But, there's a lot of good stuff out there. Blanton's I like, you know, Booker's, Weller. It's, you know, there's a ton of good stuff out there. And, you know, really, you drink what you like. So if you enjoy it, I say drink it.
Dane, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Dane Hucklebridge. His new book is Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. And I ain't had enough. Need me a triple shot of that stuff.